The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Hi, welcome to Cover to Cover. I'm Mark DeWitt. Today we have the author of his brand new book titled The Banks of Certain Rivers by John Harrison. John, welcome.
Thanks, Mark.
You know, I've heard this book talked about as in the, maybe the experience, maybe a Jodi Picoult. What do you say about that?
Well, I think it fits in with that sort of genre. It's a kind of family-oriented. There's some drama. There's some tension. Things like you might find in a Jodi Picoult book. A little different, though. There's a male protagonist, this guy, Neil. He's a popular teacher and cross-country coach at a high school in a little town in Michigan, and he runs into some troubles when he's suspended from his job after a fake video of him roughing up some kids is posted to YouTube and sort of goes viral.
Neil has a wife in the hospital. She was in a horrific accident. Tell me about that.
Neil and his wife, Wendy, they at a young age have a son, and when the son, Christopher, is in his teens, early teens, Wendy nearly drowns and is rendered, I mean, she's in a vegetative state, so she lives in a nursing home permanently. So that's one of the things that Neil is kind of dealing with. He's raising his boy and doing it alone. The thing that's going on, though, is that he's been having a bit of a secret to his son relationship, about which he's been trying to work up the courage to tell his son, but he feels like he's quite worried that his son is going to take it the wrong way or feel betrayed or something like that. So he just hasn't said anything about the fact that he's been seeing this person for a while.
As a reader, do you feel like there's kind of a dichotomy of feelings in this book? Because here you have Neil, he's trying to do everything right, you know, in my opinion, but, you know, he's lonely. His wife is in a vegetative state, and he's got kind of an affair. Sometimes you think, hey, you know, that's fantastic, and other times when you're at the hospital with him, you think, how could he?
Yeah, and that's, you're trying to, for the reader, you're trying to create that sort of question of, here he is in this situation that's terrible. You would not hope anyone to end up in a situation like that. But like you say, he is lonely, and he's in actually quite a solid relationship, but he just can't bring himself to really tell anybody about it. So you feel for him. Of course you want him to be happy and, you know, be in a supportive thing and be able to be open about it. But at the same time, yeah, you feel like, well, gosh, he's still married to this woman, even though she's not able to think or know anything about it. So,
yeah, you know, and I guess as you're reading the book, you're hoping maybe that she might come through. Maybe she does, maybe she doesn't. You have to read The Banks at Certain Rivers to find out. But that's kind of a feeling there, too, isn't it?
Well, it's pretty well established that she's not going to have any kind of recovery. One thing that does happen, and that seems to resonate quite well with people who read the book, in between each chapter, there's an email that he writes to his wife, Wendy, even though there's obviously no way she can read it or know about it. He's set up an email account for her, and it becomes sort of a, in a sense, almost like a journal for him to sort of express his thoughts and open up to her about things that are going on in his life.
When I read that, and I didn't understand why he was doing the emails until later on in the book you find out, how did you come up with that idea? Have you heard of other people doing that? Do you do that? How did that come about?
You know, it's funny. It just sort of hit me I mean, I don't know if anyone else has done it or not. And I almost, I wrote a couple of the emails and had them in, and I was a bit concerned that it would seem too much like a gimmick or something like that, that people would think it was corny to have them in there. But some trusted readers went over it, and I said, well, what do you think about those emails? Should I leave them in or take them out? And they're like, no, you gotta leave those emails in there. Those are, and they become kind of critical. Some significant plot points later on in the book are kind of revealed, some things he's been carrying around. He finally comes to admit in an email to Wendy, when really he's just admitting it to himself.
The banks of certain rivers, you have a lady in a vegetative state. You have other people, hospice. I mean, you talk about other ailments like that, the nurses, Alzheimer's. How much research did you have to do on all of that to get that in the book of the banks of certain rivers?
Interestingly enough, my day job is in marketing for a hospital in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. So I am surrounded by professionals who work in those sorts of things all the time. So it was easy for me to draw on that.
And maybe you put things together and there was somebody you trusted and you'd say, hey, what do you think of this?
It's nice to have access to people who are experts in their fields, and you can say, hey, would it work this way or would it work that way? And they set you straight. And fortunately, the ones who've read the whole thing seem to think it has the veneer of realism. That's what we shoot for anyway.
Well, let's find out about the banks of certain rivers. Here, this is taking place in Michigan, of all places, and you, of course, a writer writing this in Jackson Hole. How did that come about?
Well, originally I am from Michigan, and it's, in a way, the book is almost like a little love letter home. A lot of people think of Michigan as being just this giant auto factory or something, but when you get up north of Detroit in the central part of the state, in the northern lower peninsula, it's really beautiful, just rolling hills, and I miss it. I miss being there. Of course, I love Jackson. Is a terrific place. I like being there. But this is a good way for me to sort of think about that part of the world and reflect on it in a way. And doing it in Jackson, you know, you get separated by time and distance, and you can be maybe a little more honest about things in a way that if you were right there in the middle of it, you may not be.
So some of the beaches that you talk about in the banks of certain rivers are pretty much the old stomping ground places you used to romp around?
Oh, yeah. As a kid, I hung out in those areas quite a bit. And yeah, it's really a beautiful part of the country.
Well, you know, let's find out a little bit about Jackson Hole, Wyoming. It's got to be a lot different than the upper part, the mitten part, I guess, of Michigan.
Well, it is. We've got, you know, big mountains and elk and moose and tourists and things. That's one thing that actually is in common. In a way, you know, Jackson is a tourist town. That's its main economy. And Port Manitou, in the book, that fictitious city, is also kind of a tourist town. So I was able to draw on the realities of living in a place where people come to visit, and t-shirt shops and things like that, where you can get kind of overwhelmed by that. And as the book opens, that season, that tourism season, has kind of wound down. And in Jackson, we feel a bit of relief when we call them the shoulder seasons, in between the summertime when everyone is there to visit the national parks and the wintertime when everyone comes there to ski.
In your book, you have different threads of different stories involved. How do you make those all come out? How do you knit those into a full story?
When I first conceived of the book, I'd written a couple books prior, and I just sort of sat down and began to write and hoped that for that day I could come up with something good. But for this one, I really plotted it out a bit, and that was something I'd never really done to this extent before. I had on a wall in my house about 250 post-it notes of various colors. I could describe scenes, and I went down to the level of if it was a blue post-it note, that was present action, and if it was a green post-it note, that was past action, and if it was a yellow post-it note, that was the weather on that day. And I mean, that's just a small sampling kind of what I had going on. So it was a pretty thoroughly plotted out book in advance. And then once I had done that, and of course, by having the sticky notes, I had the ability to sort of, well, maybe this scene would work a little better here. So I'd yank it off the wall and move it over a couple feet and replace it and move it around. And then I outlined that on paper, typed it out the way that it was represented on the wall, and then from that just sort of sat down and wrote from the plan, and it went pretty well. In the end, I did, once I had a draft of the book, I did do some pretty significant rearranging, so it wasn't all solidified in the post-it note process, but it was, that was a good way to sort of keep track of those different threads.
I guess it wasn't just like maybe drawing that scene of the farmhouse and the blue sky and the mountains and then just painting in the pieces that you drew, but you're putting that together, then going back and doing some edits.
Yeah, yeah. I try to, when I draft, when I'm sitting down and typing, I try to just write quickly, get in my, whatever's in my head, just get it out there, and then go back and clean it up, smooth it out, refine it. That's been probably my biggest thing that I've learned as a writer, that it doesn't have to be perfect right off the bat, that you get it out there, and it's not like chiseling in marble. It's like working in clay. You can mold it, you can shift it around, you can smooth it out, or if you don't like it, you can rip it off and start from scratch.
Did you go around, I mean, driving, maybe shopping, maybe doing other things, and maybe you had like that stack of sticky notes where you might come up with an idea, put that down, then go home and put them where they need to be? Or is this something that you did at the writer's table?
You know, ideas come to you all the time. You just have to be ready to to accept them wherever they hit you, whether it's driving or in the shower or on a hike. That's another great thing about living in Jackson. I've got this beautiful trail right up behind my house, and I'll go up there, and quite often, I mean, it's happened more times than I can count, some resolution to a sticky problem in whatever I'm writing comes to me like a bolt from the blue, and you think, oh, well, that's how you do it, and then I'll run home, sometimes literally run home, and get it written down or make notes about it so I can not forget the sort of inspiration that hit me out there.
You know, Neil, your protagonist in the book, quite a runner, along with his son, I believe. You yourself, a runner?
When I began writing this book, I was not much of a runner. I'd run in high school or run track, and my memories of that were just kind of misery, like being forced to march along or something. But as I was writing this book, I thought, well, you know, I should figure out really the feeling of it, and I began to run. And since I've remained a runner, we have incredible trail running in Jackson, so that's kind of become my thing. So it's a good secondary benefit of the book, I guess is a way to put it.
I guess Neil was an inspiration.
Yeah,
your
yeah,
health, I guess. Well,
you could say that. And when you're writing a book, you really need something like that to keep yourself sane, because it's tough work at times. You're doubting yourself. You're thinking, oh, geez, this is the worst thing I've ever done. And you can go out for a run and kind of erase that feeling and come back and look at the page and either think, well, okay, this wasn't so bad, or if it was bad, you don't feel so terrible about just hitting the delete key and starting from scratch.
You know, I've tried running before, and reading this with Neil, it was kind of an inspiration for me to maybe get out and try it again, but he would get in a zone and he would just clear his mind, and I could never do that. I was just always thinking of the pain.
There's a the Japanese writer Haruki Murakami has a pretty terrific for anybody who likes reading about writing or reading about running. He's got this incredible memoir that he wrote called What We Talk About When We Talk About Running, which is a play on the Raymond Carver short story title, and he has a quote in there. I might mangle it, but it's something like, and he's talking about the pain of running, that pain is mandatory, but suffering is optional. So it's going to hurt no matter what, but whether you allow that to consume you and take over the way you're feeling is kind of your choice. And he talks about that both in the sense of running, the pain of doing that, and writing, the pain of doing that. You can push through, you can let it get to you, or you can just say, okay, I'm going to just keep chipping away at this thing.
John, let's talk about some of the other books that you've written. You mentioned The Banks of Certain Rivers with the post-it notes all over. You pretty much scripted things out more on this book than you did mm-hmm. the others. Mm-hmm. Did you have pretty much a pattern maybe for the other books that you followed?
You know, I made some very loose notes. I would keep a notepad to be able to write down ideas that would come to me as I was going along. I would say, though, that in any book I write, and I'm working on one now, the post-it note plotting is the way. For me, I wouldn't say that's the way everybody has to do it, but it really works well for me to be able to plan it out. And it also, just in terms of time management, when you've got all sorts of things going on, you're trying to live a regular life, to be able to sit down and be like, okay, this is my plan for today. This is the bit that I've got to write. You use your time quite a bit more effectively when you've got a vision of what you've got to do.
John, of course, you're out promoting The Banks of Certain Rivers. What's on your mind for the next book? You mentioned that you're starting to write something.
This book was, from other things that I've tried in the past, this book was a little bit of a departure, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. So something, again, in that literary Jodi Picoult vein, possibly even, I'm considering taking one of the characters from The Banks of Certain Rivers and carrying him on, actually the son, Christopher. So I wouldn't really call it a sequel, but it's a loose connection. That was one of those ideas that came to me when I was out running. Thought, I had this character that I needed to slot in. I thought, well, wouldn't Chris be great in there? He was fun to write, so I'll put him in there.
So The Banks of Certain Rivers, what kind of a time frame are we looking at with this book, and what kind of a time frame are you looking at maybe with the new book, or is it too early for that?
They come when they come. The time that it takes to write them, I tend to draft them pretty quickly. I think I wrote the first draft of this book in like 7 or 8 weeks, but I worked on revising and editing for nearly 2 years, which is where I think the real meat of the work takes place. Like I was saying, you just try to get it out there, and then you really refine it and refine it and refine it. So maybe a year, maybe 2 years. It's difficult to say.
With the time that you've spent writing other things and this brand new book, I guess the process gets a little easier every time, maybe?
It does. It really does. And not so much in terms of composition, though you become a little more efficient, like I was saying, with time management, of getting what's in your head down on the page. But also your level of confidence. You feel a little better about, okay, this is going to work, or this is maybe a little iffy. You feel more certain about where you're going and where your voice is. And that's a terrific feeling when you're kind of on at that spot on a roll and you think, oh gosh, this is, I've kind of got it together today. You feel okay. You get a good day's work out of that. You can ride on that feeling for quite some time.
John, when you're revising your books, do the characters, protagonists, do they tell you which way they want to go? Do you believe that the characters speak to you?
You have funny interactions with them in the sense that, I mean, you have no idea where some of these things come from. Obviously, they come from inside you, but they're, I mean, maybe you have a scene where you need a guy to walk in the room and close a door or something. You just need an incidental character to come in and do something. And then, without knowing it, that character has become instrumental and important in the book, and you never ever envisioned that this guy in your planning process, in your notes on your post-it notes or whatever, you never ever thought that this person would show up and be an important part of what you were creating. And those sorts of discoveries are such a blast. It's like, oh, hey, this is terrific. Where did this come from? And how did I do this? And you kind of laugh to yourself and think, well, all right, this is great. With that said, there are other days where you are sitting there staring at the blank screen and just wishing that something like that, that one of those beautiful things would happen, and it doesn't. And you think, oh, oh. And you wait and you wait and you type, and maybe you go back the next day and erase whatever you came up with that day. But I mean, some days those great ideas come out of nowhere, and other days you're digging and digging and digging and hoping you hit a vein of something, some sort of inspiration.
So what is your day as a writer like? I mean, some people use this as an 8-hour-a-day job. They go in, write 8 hours, and then go do other things. How does that work for you?
When I was younger, I was more of a night owl sort of person. I could stay up late and write, and that just doesn't work for me anymore. It's too exhausting. And I mean, when you're young and you don't have much to worry about, it's not that big a deal. But I've got children. I'm not at a point with my writing where that's the only thing I'm doing. So I've got work that I've got to do. So now I find that getting up early and writing in the morning, which, I mean, it's if I could send this message to my younger self to say, you know, someday you'll be like, you'll want to get up early and do stuff, I would have thought, what, you're crazy. But it's really my favorite time. My head is clear. Things are quiet. I'm not stressed out by anything that's gone on over the course of the day. So I get up, I knock out. I mean, if I can do 1,000 words or 1,500 words, that's good. And then go through my day, do my stuff, and take a look at those pages later on after I've had some time away from them. That's a pretty good routine for me. That goes well.
Yeah, it's too bad that younger you didn't find that Post-it note.
I know, right?
You know, there was an author, and he was a New York Times bestselling author, and I cannot for the life of me remember who it was, but he said he took pieces of paper and he would write down scenes and he'd throw them in a jar, and maybe at the end of the year or something, he'd toss them all out on the table and he would put them. It was almost like a puzzle, and he'd put them together, and that's how he'd get his book.
You know, I've heard that story, and I can't think who it is either. But I'll tell you a funny thing. In our school district back in Jackson, I have been for the past few years doing a writer's group for fifth graders, and it's been I sort of got roped into it at first and thought, oh boy, this is what am I in for? And I found it to be really the most joyous, inspiring thing. These kids are so clever and so smart, and they're old enough to really kind of have identities in terms of what they want to create artistically, but they're not so old that they're jaded and cynical about stuff yet. So they write these amazing things. They're usually an imitation of whatever they're writing at the time, and I have to kind of rein them in and try to say, okay, you know, we're not going to write the Harry Potter book here. I just want a page of a story. Their imaginations can kind of really get away from them. But from what you were saying, one exercise I have them do, and they love it, we do it pretty much every time we meet, I have a stack of different colored note cards, and I hand them out. So I'll give everybody a green one, a blue one, a yellow one, and I'll say, okay, guys, on the green one, I want you to write a verb. On the other one, I want you to write a noun. On the other one, I want you to write an adjective. And then I collect them, and we mix them up and pass them back around and say, okay, now you've got to write a story with whatever you ended up with. And they'll come up with, I mean, sometimes it's really quite, I usually give bonus points for humor. So if they come up with something funny, and often they come up with something really funny. So it's a kind of a fun prompt, and it works for kids and it works for adults. I don't do anything kind of like that myself, but it's a fun thing for them.
Well, if we wanted to find out more about your brand new book, The Banks of Certain Rivers, I'm sure you've got a website.
I have. It's www.harrisonpages.com.
And when we go to harrisonpages.com, what are we going to find out?
Oh, you'll be able to see, you know, some little praise for the book. Of course, I've got everybody who, you know, everybody who loves the book. I've got a get a blurb from them on there. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, there are a couple blurbs on there. You can read a sample of the book. There's a link to buy the book from wherever you like to, independent bookstores or Amazon or wherever you like to go. You can get it on there. There's a little bio, pictures of Jackson. You can, if anybody's interested in that, they can check it out.
All right. Well, the book is The Banks of Certain Rivers. I mean, you're going to love this book. You're going to find Neil and his wife who has had such a horrific accident. He's a lonely man. He finds somebody else. And, you know, and plus, not only that, but another string in this story is there's a man trying to buy his land. And now he realizes he's not going to buy it, so maybe he could buy some of it. He wants to put in that great golf course on the banks of certain rivers. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.